You're with us for the morning show as we trace the origin stories of some of the rejected ballots from April's primary election. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Investigative journalists from American Public Media and Wisconsin Watch, they teamed up to look more closely at the nearly 14,000 ballots that were thrown out due to voters not getting the signature and or the witness requirement correct. They wanted to suss out where voters went wrong in casting their ballot and what these rejected ballots of all stripes, what the implications may be for November's general election. Are you voting absentee in upcoming elections? Have you had difficulty in the past casting a ballot through the mail? How was it to get a witness to sign off on your ballot? What happened? We're at 800-642-1234. Tom Scheck is an investigative reporter for APM Reports. It's the investigative and documentary unit of American Public Media based in St. Paul. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey there. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. We also have Dee Hall, who is co-founder of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. Dee, welcome back.
Thanks a lot for having me again.
Well, Dee, let's start with you with some more big picture, broader strokes here. What did the pandemic and the ensuing public health advice to stay at home, what did that reveal about Wisconsin's mail-in voting system?
Well, first of all, a lot of people, as you know, were nervous about going to the polls because the whole state was on under the safer at home order. And so while normally single digit percentages of voters would vote mail in or absentee, instead, it was in the double digits, and sometimes it was up to 10 times as many voters as normally we would have voting absentee or mail in. And so what it revealed was that we're really not ready. The April 7th election revealed that Wisconsin is really not quite ready for this type of avalanche of mail-in and absentee balloting.
Well, Tom, over 23,000 absentee ballots from the April primary were thrown out. You wanted to dig into these ballots. What were you interested in?
Well, we knew that there was a lot of interest in the lost ballots in the U.S. mail and the Postal Service. We knew that this was a chaotic election around the polls. And one of the things that kept jumping out at us was that there were so many people who voted absentee, and we wanted to take a better look into that system. And once we started to look into the system and look at the data, we really found that there were a lot of people that just made mistakes, frankly. And when you have to file, or you cast a ballot absentee or vote by mail in Wisconsin, you need to sign the back of the envelope, and you need to find a witness to sign it and put their address on there. And what we were finding is that one of those three things, or all of them, did not occur for about almost 14,000 voters in the April election. And so that just jumped out at us as a big red flag, because we know that there's been a lot of elections officials, a lot of public health officials have been saying, make sure you vote by mail this year to make sure you don't spread the COVID-19, and that this is a good way to reduce it. And so one of the things we found was we wanted to take a look at what's the underlying problems with voting by mail. And this was a key one.
It was interesting to me, too, that you tracked down some of these voters who had their ballots rejected, and that when you contacted them, this was their first understanding that their ballot hadn't been counted.
Right. We asked for all of the data of everyone who had their ballot rejected, and by law, the Wisconsin Election Commission had to give that to us, so they did. And so we started calling folks. Dee and I started calling folks, and one of the things that really jumped out at us was that we were the first ones to inform them. Some people were like, what? Are you serious? I can't believe this. And that really was a big signal to us that, okay, Wisconsin is not a vote by mail state. The state typically votes, the voters go to the polls on election day, or they vote early, but they don't cast a ballot through the mail. And so one of the things that occurs is that there needs to be this learning curve of folks who have to go through the process of doing it. And one of the things that elections officials are learning is there has to be a way for them to notify voters as well, because without that notification, voters who think that they are casting a ballot and it's being counted don't know at all unless they're notified.
I should add that Wisconsin, the clerks in Wisconsin are not required to notify voters if there's a problem with their ballot. They're encouraged to do that, but it's not a requirement. And so on April 7th, as the clerks got overwhelmed, a lot of them simply ran out of time to do that.
We're speaking with APM investigative reporter Tom Scheck and Wisconsin Watch managing editor Dee Hall. They investigated the rejected ballots from Wisconsin's April primary to better understand where voters went wrong in casting ballots. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's hear from one of the voters you talked with. This is Bob Capon, a voter who had the experience of his ballot being thrown out.
There should be some, you know, warning. You know, you must have witness signature, you know, something like that, or ballot could be voided. I mean, if you saw things like that, you'd be, oh, I got to pay attention here. I don't want to have my ballot voided.
So, Dee, the witness signature requirement tripped up voters. What does that tell you there about what this whole system looks like and what is in place?
Well, I talked to the head of the Wisconsin Municipal Clerks Association, and her explanation was that the ballot envelope is really packed with information. And to successfully fill out one of these ballots, and the envelope is the very, very important part of it. The ballot's inside, but the envelope is the one that if every line that you are required to fill out is not filled out, it will get rejected. They don't weigh or balance that. If you do not have the address of the witness, for example, and that's what happened in the case of Bob and his wife, Jan. They did not have their own home address there for the witness signature. It will get rejected. And so I think the idea is that voters who are unfamiliar with absentee balloting, and the Capons are among those, often miss a single line or a single box. And as a result, their ballot will be rejected.
Let's hear from another voter that you talked with. This is Ricky Casey, a voter from Cedarburg.
Everyone's trusting that if you follow the directions on your ballot that you get in the mail, that you will be counted because you follow the rules.
So, Tom, you know, when these voters that you talked with started exploring what possibly had gone wrong with their ballot, what questions did they have of you?
Well, the first thing is, how did you find out? when we explained that to them? The second thing, for most of the folks that I talked with, and I think even for Dee, a lot of them assured us that they filled this out correctly. And what we did is then we put open records requests into the elections officials and said, hey, we want to see their ballot envelope. Now, we never saw who they voted for. We never saw their ballot, but we saw their ballot envelope. And in many instances, what occurred was we saw the ballot envelope. It had their signature. It had the witness signature, but then there wasn't an address on there. That was the thing that appeared to trip a lot of folks up, especially the ones who the spouses were the witnesses, because if you look at the ballot envelope above, it will say Tom Scheck, 1234 Smith Avenue, or whatever the address would be. So my spouse would automatically think, well, it's just, we live at the same house. Why do I need to put the address down? And so that
because
was one of the
address
things that tripped
is right
up.
There.
It's exactly the same, and it's above. So some folks later thought, well, I thought I didn't have to do that because we lived at the same address. And so that was one of the issues involved. Now, there is one other thing that occurred with a little bit of this, and I have to say that there was a point in time, and this is how confusing this April primary was, where a judge did say a witness was not required. And so there could have been some people who didn't have a witness within this 14,000 or so absentee ballots who just said, okay, I don't have to have a witness. I'll just cast my ballot and send it in. But then that ruling ended up being reversed by a higher court later on. And so they may not have never fixed those ballots.
We're talking with investigative journalists Tom Scheck from APM Reports and Dee Hall from Wisconsin Watch. They teamed up to look more closely at rejected ballots from April. What do you plan on doing in November? Did you vote by mail in April's primary? Was it your first time to vote absentee? How did it go? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring new investigative reporting around the thousands of rejected ballots from April's primary election. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The analysis from APM Reports and Wisconsin Watch serves as a case study of sorts of what might lie ahead for swing states like Wisconsin that are inundated by absentee ballot applications and may lack the systems in place to meet the influx of mail-in ballot requests. Do you worry about absentee ballots getting counted? Do you worry about the time it will take to count mail-in ballots in proximity to the election being called for a candidate? Join in 800-642-1234. Dee Hall is managing editor at Wisconsin Watch, and Tom Scheck is an investigative reporter with APM Reports. Let's take a call now. Mary Kay is joining us from Kenosha. Hi, Mary Kay.
Good morning. I was a voting inspector. I have one question. What is the reasoning for a witness? You get mailed a ballot at the ballot box. You go in there by yourself. You have one mailing address. You get one ballot. What is the reason for a witness?
Mary Kay, thank you. Dee?
Well, obviously, at some point, officials in the state of Wisconsin thought that was important, but I do think that's an interesting question, and I will tell you that we'll be exploring that in a future story. Is, you know, this whole issue of the witness is very interesting. I understand it's an anti-fraud measure, but as the election inspector mentioned, you're getting one ballot at one address, addressed to one person. And the only way for that to be fraudulent, I guess, would be for somebody else to grab it away from you, which seems pretty unlikely if it's just coming to your home. So I think that is an interesting issue. As an election inspector, I don't know if she's still on the phone. I don't know whether they even look at those signatures to figure out, are those real people? And does that real person's signature, which of course might be illegible, match up with the actual address that the witness put down? So I don't know. I do wonder about it.
Right. Mary Kay, is there any type of verification there of the witness?
No. When you sign in, they just look you up by name.
Tom, do you want to add anything?
Most of the states use some kind of identification or something to ensure that the voter is the voter who is in question. And so there's 9 states, Wisconsin is one of them, that require a witness signature. There's 3 states that either require 2 witnesses or a notary. Missouri actually requires you to have a notary agent sign it. And then a lot of other states do something which is called signature match. And so I would sign when I sign into the poll book initially, or when I register, I have a signature on file. And then when I vote absentee, they would match the signature on the absentee ballot envelope with the one on file. And they say, consider that signature match. Now, every single one of these has issues with it, because if you're an older voter, maybe your motor skills have deteriorated, your signature doesn't look the same way, the match in that instance also may not work as well, and that could get cast out as well. But most of this is an anti-fraud measure to ensure the voter who says it's the voter casts that ballot.
I want to go ahead, Dee.
I should add that Wisconsin does not have signature matching, though that's not how they do the verification, just so people in Wisconsin understand. They're not trying to check your signature against the signature you registered with, because as Tom mentioned, your signature can change over time and in different circumstances. And so we don't have that. And I would say luckily we don't, because I think there's a lot of judgment that goes into that, and some of it has been highly criticized.
I want to bring into the conversation here my ballot envelope. I voted absentee in April, and again in August here I have a ballot, and I noticed that on my envelope, the area where you have your signature, you have your witness address, those lines were highlighted in different colors. And I put my envelope up against the light to say, did someone really highlight this by hand? Do you have, Tom, any idea about that?
Well, that's the kind of signal that the Wisconsin elections officials are trying to tell you, do this sign here. But there's a lot on that envelope. And when we talked to a lot of elections officials across the country, they said that envelope design matters a lot, because the way that the Wisconsin one is, while there are yellow lines on there that kind of signal that something needs to be done on those lines. In other instances, it's kind of like when you refinance a mortgage or do a mortgage where there's big bright lines saying sign here, initial here. And the elections officials say the most successful vote by mail initiatives are the ones where they have like those clear signals. It's not very complicated. And it just says you need to do this to have your vote count. But those yellow lines are what are on most of the ballot envelopes that you're talking about.
Wow. So do you think someone was doing this by hand, Dee, like actually highlighting the areas that were really important for my ballot?
It depends on the municipality where you live, because they're the ones who are deciding, you know, how to present the envelope to some extent. It's not required, but many of them do put a yellow highlight on the lines that absolutely must be filled out by everyone. One confusing part that I heard when we showed the envelope to Bob Capon, he looked closely at the line that he hadn't filled out, and he recalled that he might have been confused about his need to fill that out, because it's right close, very tiny type, right close to a section where you have to have somebody sign it if someone assisted you in putting the ballot together, which in voting, you know, in filling out the ballot. He didn't have any assistance, didn't need to fill out that line, but the other line, the one that he did have to fill out, was kind of right there. And so he left both of them blank, and thinking that this was something to do with this voter assistance, and it wasn't. And so, you know, it's the practice that of many clerks is to highlight those lines. But again, the lines are close together. It's easy to kind of miss some of those highlights.
And not to mention, I needed my reading glasses because it is very small print. We're talking with APM investigative reporter Tom Scheck and Wisconsin Watch managing editor Dee Hall. They teamed up to look more closely at the rejected ballots from Wisconsin's April primary and the implications heading into November. We're at 800-642-1234. Let's hear from an election official that you talked with, and this is Tracy Setti, city clerk for the city of Cedarburg.
Right now we're getting probably about 15 to 20 ballots back every day now, and every single day there is a little stack that is missing some information.
And I'm thinking that that little stack, Tom, and that little stack growing and growing and growing each day, what's going on?
Well, this is, I talked to her in early July, and this is for the August primary that she was referring to. And what she's doing is she said she was setting aside ballots that had one of those three things missing. And she said she was going to make efforts to call those voters. But no, she doesn't have to do that. She said she was going to do it at least once to try and make sure everyone knows that they can come in and fix the problem. But this is what one of the reasons that we wanted to look at Wisconsin. Everybody knows Wisconsin is a swing state. President Trump won it by 23,000 votes. And when you start to add up these cast aside ballots, you start to see that, oh, this really matters. Now, not all of those nearly 14,000 ballots that were tossed in April were Democrats. But this starts to show the volume of ballots that could get cast aside. When I talked to a University of Florida elections expert, he said that there were 300,000 ballots tossed in 2016, and he expects that number to be well over a million in November. And so you're starting to see that there's a lot of voters out there who could have their ballots tossed for just an honest mistake or an error.
Let's bring in Rachel now in Lake Delton. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question on when I send my ballot in, does someone actually see who I vote for, or is it somehow anonymous with my name and who I'm voting for? Thanks for taking my call.
No, this is a very key question. So you put your ballot in a ballot envelope, and then it goes into another envelope, which you sign. And so what happens is when they go through and they look at this, they'll check the information. Did you sign it? Did the witness sign it? Did the witness have an address on there? And then they put those in a pile, and then they go either to your local precinct to be counted with your neighbors, or they go to a absentee ballot board where it will be counted and checked and counted there. But nobody knows what your ballot is, because it starts to get put into a different pile at one point.
Okay. So Dee, go ahead.
I was just going to say that what they do with those ballots that are in these envelopes, they're the exact same ballot that you would fill out if you had gone to the polls. And so what they do is they just feed it through the machine. So they're not looking at it and trying to match you up with your vote. They're just trying to open the envelope to make sure you fulfilled those requirements. And then the ballot is just as anonymous as the ballot that I cast when I go to the polls and they give me, I'm voter number 273. You know, they know who voter 273 is and that I have a ballot, but they're not scrutinizing who I'm voting for. I just put it in the machine.
And very quickly here, the ballot then envelope wouldn't be opened if something was wrong with those signatures and information on that envelope?
That's correct. So like in Wisconsin or in Minnesota where I lived in 2008, there was a U.S. Senate race, right, where it was very competitive. There was a recount. And so what happens is all those ballot envelopes have to be kept in a pile in case they're challenged later on in court, which occurred in Minnesota in 2008. And some of those ballots were wrongly rejected. They got thrown back into the pile. So they have to keep those envelopes on file so folks can inspect them later on.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks
for having us.
Tom Scheck is a reporter for APM Reports, the investigative unit of American Public Media. Dee Hall, managing editor of Wisconsin Watch. We have a link to their report titled Narrow Margin. Find it at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, we look at the increased demand at food pantries. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we check in on the food bank situation amid the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. On Capitol Hill, negotiations continue on the next coronavirus relief package. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday said the $600 a week federal unemployment benefit was helping people like single moms to put food on the table.
When people are hungry in our country, children, millions of children are food insecure. Many families who never thought they'd go to a food bank are going to food banks, and we need more money for food stamps and emergency nutrition programs.
Have you sought out a food pantry since the pandemic? Has it helped your family? Do you volunteer at a food bank? Where is it and what does it offer? Do you donate to your local pantry? What do you provide? We're at 800-642-1234. Stephanie Young-Dorfman is Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. It's a network of food banks that sources and provides food to local programs. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So how is Feeding Wisconsin doing during the pandemic?
Yeah, great question. So our network of our six Feeding America member food banks and almost 1,000 local food programs, including food pantries, is experiencing a large shift in the way that we do business. We have experienced increase in demand, declines in donation of food due to the pandemic, and completely flipped on its head our distribution model as we move to contactless drive-up, walk-up distributions to keep everyone, including our pantry guests and volunteers, safe during this time.
Yeah, how have you changed to accommodate social distancing? What does that look like for food banks?
Yeah, so most of our food banks have seen a decrease in volunteers at the food banks themselves. So in the way of sorting, handling, transporting food, we relied on more temporary staff to get that job done. And then at the point of distribution to our pantry guests at pantries, most of our pantries have moved to, like I said, drive-up or walk-up distributions where folks will pull their car right up, open their trunk, and let a volunteer or pantry staff member put a box of food right in their trunk, and then they'll shut that and drive away. So our network has typically had a much of a choice model where folks will come in and similarly to a grocery store, be able to select the foods that they would like to eat for their family, take home to their family for the weeks ahead. Unfortunately, we've had to switch to this prepackaged box distribution to keep everyone safe. And that's been the biggest shift.
With these prepackaged boxes, are families still getting access to enough fresh produce like the fruits and vegetables?
Absolutely. Most of our food banks and pantries are distributing typically boxes of fresh product, cooler product, also some freezer products, and shelf-stable product within those boxes. So we have done well to source the same variety of food that we've tried to do in the past pre-COVID.
So what has volunteering been like to assemble these boxes and to keep the food getting out to the people who, your guests who need it?
Yeah, so many of our food banks, like I said, have cut their volunteer capacity short, mostly to keep our volunteers safe. So in order to keep social distancing, in order to have the room for storage and sorting of an increased amount of product in our warehouses, we've had to cut our volunteer capacity back. We also rely on a lot of older adults as our volunteers. Most of our consistent volunteers are individuals who are retired, and those folks are usually or in the situation of being some of the most vulnerable individuals in the time of the pandemic. So we've, in some cases, asked them to stay home and stay safe, and instead hired some temporary staff from the service industry to keep folks working and to keep our food banks going.
You've mentioned that 40% of families coming through pantries now have never used pantry services, food banks, before. What are they saying, and how is this first exposure to a food bank? What is it like?
Sure. So unfortunately, we're in a time that hunger and the experience of food insecurity is a much more normalized thing, as we're seeing unemployment rates go up and many more households struggling to put food on their table. There are many families that are making tough decisions that we've seen in the past. Many of our households pre-COVID come to our pantries because they've experienced a financial or medical hardship, and they need something to help them get by. Unfortunately, like I said, right now, those who are having those experiences are much more common and having to find ways to make their budget work, making trade-offs about thinking about how they pay their rent or pay their medical bills or put food on their table. And oftentimes food is the most flexible of their budget items. So that's what brings them to our pantry lines. So we try to make that experience as dignified as we can, providing culturally appropriate and diet-appropriate foods. Like I said, unfortunately, right now, we are distributing much more standardized foods in family boxes than before. But, you know, the folks that we're seeing right now are making those tough decisions, but also finding that our pantries are a place to access food to get them through the next week or the next couple weeks as they try to find income to support their family in other ways. Our pantries have experienced variable increases or decreases in need right now. The last few months, we have seen the supports of the stimulus that many Americans received help them out. We've also seen some SNAP or the program formerly known as food stamps increase for some families. Pandemic EBT has provided some extra support for families with kids who are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And some of those supports have gotten folks through these last few months. What we're starting to see is a larger number of folks needing food. Our demand is increasing the last few weeks as some of those other supports are falling off. So that's when we're seeing an even larger number of people who have never accessed our services before show up to our pantry lines.
We're talking with Stephanie Young-Dorfman, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. It's a network of food banks that sources and provides food to local programs. We're looking at demands and the impact amid the pandemic. You can join in. Does your family participate in food assistance programs? Are you in SNAP? What does food insecurity look like in your community? Does your community offer food pantries? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie, back in April, dairy farmers were dumping milk amid COVID due to the industry surplus. We heard reports of livestock euthanized due to reductions at processing plants and supply-demand issues. And, you know, as we read these headlines, we were saying, why in the world can't food banks get at all these products from our farmers? Did any of that surplus food or milk make it to our food banks?
Yes, I'm pleased to say it has. So we have had some strong relationships in the past and during COVID times with our Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin, our Wisconsin Beef Council. And those were two partners that we worked with, along with Rural Mutual Insurance, to access some of that milk to make butter. Butter has a high ratio of milk to butter, so we were able to move a lot of milk that way. We also had a relationship with the Beef Council to receive a donation of beef for our statewide network. So we have those great relationships with our commodity associations, and our food banks are constantly working with local growers, producers, processors, to access the rich resources of our Wisconsin agricultural system.
Were those connections in place pre-COVID, or did those things come together as you saw the agriculture community reeling and not knowing, you know, how to, you know, find outlets for the produce mm-hmm. and the milk?
Yeah, so those relationships did, well, we've had some of them previously. Our campaign with Rural Mutual Insurance and the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin did come out of those stories and the period of time in which our dairy farmers were struggling. So it's really exciting to see partnerships like that either develop or strengthen in those times of need. And it's really impressive to me that we can pull together a program that can both support our farmers and support the families in need across our state.
Let's look at the grant programs here that from the for the Food Security Initiative from the Evers Administration. You applied mm-hmm. for the first round of grants last week. What will these grants do?
Yeah, so the Food Security Initiative that came out of Governor Evers' office provides an opportunity for CARES Act money to come through DACCAP to support our food security network. The first round of funding is focused on infrastructure. So in that application, we included a budget for infrastructure for transportation, storage, handling. That includes stands, coolers, freezers, other equipment for contactless distribution. And those sorts of equipment and supplies are needed both at the food bank level and at our pantry level to keep our operations running smoothly in a time like this, and also to help us meet this increase of demand of the number of households coming through our doors and the amount of food that we are anticipating needing to distribute in the coming year. Our food banks are anticipating the need to more than double the amount of food that they distributed over last year, and we're also anticipating that the peak of need will come this fall, where we're expecting to see more than 60 or 70% increase in the households we're serving. So these supports will provide our network with the means to do that.
We're talking with Stephanie Young-Dorfman, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. Do you rely on local food pantries? Does your community offer enough of them? What will the fall look like for food? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Stephanie Young-Dorfman here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about the spike in hunger as families seek out their local food pantries during the global health crisis. Feeding America says that food insecurity has grown nationally to more than 54 million people due to the pandemic. What does food insecurity look like in your community? Does your area offer food pantry services? Are food bank offerings enough to help families? Where are potential shortcomings? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Stephanie Young-Dorfman heads up Feeding Wisconsin, and she stays with us. Stephanie, as you look toward fall and offering double the amount of food that food banks offered last year, how do you ramp up?
Yeah, so our food banks are already preparing, like I said, both in the way of ramping up infrastructure, but also looking at how we're going to source that much more product. Typically, in pre-COVID times, our food banks purchase about 20% of the product they distribute and rely on donations for the other 80%. Right now, our food banks are purchasing about 60% of the food that is distributed, which is a very large shift, both in the way that we're sourcing food and the resources it takes to do that. Like I said, our food banks have strong relationships with local producers and processors. Unfortunately, we're at a time when our supply chain is struggling a bit to keep up with demand, both to our grocery stores and also maintaining the capacity for us to access some of that purchased product. One of the great resources that we're looking forward to is the second round of VATCAP applications for CARES Act funding that has the opportunity to provide some funding to source local Wisconsin agricultural products that might help serve that need.
Why do you think donations are down?
Food donations, I should say, are down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that is because, like I said, our grocers are also struggling to keep up with demand. Much of our donated product comes from grocers and manufacturers. Our network relies on recovering a lot of products that comes through mainstream retailers that then we can distribute to those in need. And as you might see at a grocery store, if you're in especially the shelf-stable aisles, some grocers are putting limits to the number of cans that you can purchase right now because of some of those supply chain issues. So as we're seeing those disruptions in our food system, our food banks are not receiving the same donations at the end as we would in normal times.
How are monetary donations right now?
Yeah, we're receiving great community support at a time when our food banks really need it. Like I said, we're purchasing so much more product. We are hiring more staff to get this work done. And we're so thankful for the community support that we're receiving. I know that many of our food banks are considering budgets that are nearly doubling their budget of last year to accommodate this increase in demand that we see in the coming year. But we also see that this is not a short-term challenge that we're faced with. We're in this for the long haul, and we expect that this increase in demand and increase in need for our services is going to continue at least through the next year, if not longer.
You've also worked with Wisconsin Innovation Kitchen. Can you tell us about that project?
We a couple of years ago worked with them on an applesauce project where we were able to source some seconds of apples to package some single serving unsweetened applesauce that we distributed throughout our network. Those are the types of projects that we're really looking to do more of if funding and capacity allows. It's really challenging this year to come up with some of those innovative projects in the middle of our growing season. Unfortunately, COVID hit at a time when farmers had already planned what they'd be growing for the coming year, for this current year, and that restricts us a little bit in some of those innovative programs. But we're definitely looking at ways that we can use small processors to secure some shelf-stable products that will help us get through the coming winter.
We're talking with Stephanie Young-Dorfman, Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. We're checking in on food banks amid the pandemic. Stephanie, you've reached out to tribal nation growers and producers as well as Hmong farmers to support their efforts. What are those partnerships looking like?
Yeah, we're definitely working on them. I think the strength that our state has is some opportunities for aggregating crops. So by working with aggregators, we are able to support small family farms, such as Hmong farmers, by purchasing their product through an aggregator.
What is an aggregator?
An aggregator is usually it's part of an organization that will basically compile the produce available from multiple family farms and then be able to create a produce list for the week of what is available to organizations like food banks so that we can have more of a one-stop shop rather than having to work with, say, 20 small family farms. We can go to one person, make a large purchase of all of that produce that is available. So it takes out some of the need to have many, many conversations to get the amount of food that our network needs.
And so how are those aggregators then connecting with tribal nation growers and Hmong farmers?
Sure. So there is an aggregator here in the Southwest that works very closely with many Hmong farmers to ensure that their product has an outlet. Our tribal nations, we're still in conversation with. Unfortunately, they are experiencing some of the same challenges that other growers are in this time. And I have to say that what we've also heard from many family farms, both Hmong and tribal nation growers, is that they've also shifted the amount of product that they plan to grow this year because of some uncertainty in their access to farmers markets and outlets for purchasing, for selling product. So we're doing what we can to see what might be available. Unfortunately, facing some of those same kind of roadblocks, but continuing our conversations and working very closely with VATCAP as they have strong relationships with these growers as well.
Have you watched what food insecurity approaches are being taken as the next federal stimulus comes together?
Yes, been trying to keep an eye, and our network is calling for some supports, especially calling for a 15% increase to our SNAP benefits nationwide. We know that SNAP is an efficient, effective way to provide food resources to those in need. And SNAP not only helps to stimulate the economy, but also relieve some of the strain on our emergency food network, which is something that we would very much appreciate in the coming months as we're expecting these demands to increase.
If you see the weekly federal unemployment benefit reduced from $600 as it has expired now to $200, what impact would that have for families trying to buy food?
Yeah. So we know that that supplemental unemployment insurance is what has been getting a lot of families through during these last few months. We're expecting that that's going to have a large impact on food security, as we know that people are making some tough decisions right now about where they're putting their limited budgets to continue to pay rent or their utilities, and oftentimes food is that last budget item, that most flexible budget item that they can take some shortcuts on. So we are anticipating with unemployment insurance supplements and some of these other safety net stimulus supports waning, that we are going to see an increase of need. We already have in the last few weeks, and we're expecting that to continue through the remainder of the year, unless there are some changes from the federal government to provide some supports.
Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much, Kate.
Stephanie Young-Dorfman is Executive Director of Feeding Wisconsin. It's a network of food banks that sources and provides food to local programs. Just ahead, we'll hear about how psychedelic drugs are being used to treat depression and other mental illnesses, and we'll learn about how rural health clinics and providers are faring during the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.